The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. And on today's program, we're going to be talking a little bit about the North American British Music Studies Association, which is holding its biennial conference at the University of Illinois next week, partly about, well, rather a lot about, the concert which will close that conference, and quite a bit as well about the person in whom that concert for whom that concert is in honor. I've got all my prepositions wrong. Who is Professor Emeritus of Musicology at the University of Illinois, Nicholas Temperley, who turns 80 very soon. And he was the first president of the North American British Music Studies Association and has made all kinds of contributions to various aspects of musicology. He's with us on the program today. Also with us is Professor Christina Bashford, who is principal organizer of not only the concert, but the conference as well. And it was her brainchild, as I recall. And we'll be hearing samples of music that'll be performed by three area ensembles on that concert, which will be on the 28th of July. You're listening to Live and Local. Stay tuned. As we get into the repeat of the opening music from that piece, I will tell you what you've been listening to. It's music by William Sterndale Bennett, composer, 19th century composer from England, born 1816, and it was the overture to something called The May Queen. That is one of the pieces that will be on the concert next Saturday, the two Saturdays from now, July the 28th. It'll be performed by the Prairie Ensemble, one of three local ensembles, that arts organizations that are participating in this concert. The other two are the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, their orchestra, and especially their chorus, and also a new-ish ensemble called the Prairie Voices. Each of those two groups will perform some music on their own, and then everybody, all three groups, will combine for the end of the program. The concert is the culminating event in the biennial conference happening at the University of Illinois next week of the North American British Music Studies Association. And it's called Anglo-American Musical Connections, a concert in honor of Nicholas Temperley on his 80th birthday. Nicholas is a professor emeritus of musicology at the University of Illinois. He's joining us on the show today. Also joining us is Professor Christina Bashford, who is also a professor, technically associate professor of musicology at the University of Illinois. Both of them from England, and in honor of you both, I have to tell you, I'm drinking English breakfast tea instead of my usual coffee. So we'll hear some nice accents on the program today, and want to hear especially some about Nicholas, but I want to hear first from Christina. I mean, given partly that you're English, but also given especially that you're a musicologist, when did you first hear of Nicholas Temperley and his work? And you happen to remember?
I can tell you exactly that.
Really?
Yes, I can. I was a fledgling graduate student in the middle of the 1980s, and I had decided my topic was going to be about musical life in Britain, London in particular, in the mid-19th century, and chamber music in particular. And I remember, like a good little student, doing all my bibliography and trying to find out what had been written on this topic. And the answer was very little indeed. But then I came across this dissertation from Cambridge University by somebody called Nicholas Temperley, and it was on instrumental music in Britain, just in my period. And it was this fantastic discovery. And then I thought, well, this is the person I need to study with. You know, who is Nicholas Temperley? So I tried to find this out, and then I discover he's in this place called the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I'm in London. So that sort of put the lid on that. But yeah, that was the first time I came across his work. And isn't it weird and amazing that I'm actually now working in the same department and doing all this?
And he's all retired and everything.
Yeah. So time marches on. Huh?
So you never do actually get to do those studies, but at least you can rub shoulders.
Oh, I get to study with him now still.
Yes. We talk about all kinds of things. And actually the same, it's in a way kind of repeats what happened to me as a fledgling graduate student in the 1950s, but I was in Cambridge and, well, there wasn't any. I mean, I also decided to study Victorian music, but it was mostly because I got tired of people saying that there wasn't any such thing, or if there was, that it wasn't worth considering. So I was more or less on my own, but I rather enjoyed sort of asserting myself against the advice of all my professors and things, and so I went ahead. But then, having had enough of Cambridge after 7 years there, I decided to see something quite different and came to the University of Illinois on a postdoctoral fellowship, and back in 1959, and I got an extraordinary welcome, and have never regretted being here ever since, because people let you do what you want to do, and they were quite happy to have me writing about music that they didn't really know existed, and or talking about it. But of course, then I went back to Cambridge for a while, came here finally in 1967, and have been here ever since. And I've had wonderful resources here in the library and my colleagues and a lot of support for my research. So I've really been very fortunate in getting support for work on Victorian music, which I don't think I would have got in England, at least not at that time.
Do you, you said that you in part started to study this area of music to be contrary, essentially. You
know? Well.
and also because that, you know, didn't people weren't doing much study of it. But did you have a particular interest in this music and love of this music yourself in the first place?
I have to confess that it wasn't just to be contrary. I've always loved Victoria. I started off by loving Victorian hymn tunes when we had compulsory chapel at school, and people said, oh, that's Victorian stuff, you don't want to take any notice of that. This is when I started imitating them in my compositions, people were really shocked.
That style in your own work?
In my own work. And so I sort of thought, you know, this is good stuff. And then I got to know Gilbert Sullivan and so on. And I just couldn't see why one shouldn't treat this as seriously as any other music, even though there wasn't a big name composer other than Sullivan.
Well, what were people's problem, or what was people's problem with this style? Why did they
so dismissed? Well, I've been asking myself that question for a long time. I don't know that I really have the answer. Maybe Christina does.
I don't know. I mean, there was surely a backlash against all things Victorian in the early to middle of the 20th century. I mean, so, you know, people hated Victorian furniture. They hated Victorian drapes and things like that. And music probably sort of got bundled in with that. And it was only then towards the end of the 20th century, was when I come into the picture, that we're all starting to say, well, what's the problem with this? Actually, this is quite interesting. And actually, this music really is quite something. And, you know, by that point, Victorian didn't have quite the same sort of overtones.
Yes, well, in the Second World War, people prayed to have the Germans bomb the Albert Memorial. But now it's all been covered with guilt, and everybody thinks it's wonderful. But of course, it's much easier if you have a change of taste. The buildings are still there. You can go and look at them, and look at them with new eyes. The picture galleries are there. You can get the books out again and try them again. But it's much more difficult with music, because first of all, you have to arrange for someone to perform the music before there's any way people can change their opinion of it or revise their. Or really just get to know it at all, because for a long time there was practically no Victorian music being done. And so we've been working on this, I've been working on this for a long time, trying to revive some of that music, and with some success, but not as much as I would have liked. And then in recent times there's been a great interest in, not so much in the music, but in music in Victorian life. People always used to call England das Land ohne Musik, the country without music. We now know that it was very far from being the case, that it was a fantastic amount of musical activity going on. And people like Christina, among others, have been studying this and coming up with some very interesting new material.
The piece we opened the program with of William Sterndale Bennett, so that would be one of those. He would be squarely in this time period.
Oh, yes.
And that overture and all the pieces on this particular recording, among those pieces that don't get played, haven't gotten played much. I think there's maybe two recordings at the most of any of them. So that's an example of the sort of thing you're talking about. But isn't it true that there is one forum for a lot of Victorian music, and that was and is the English church?
Yes, well, the English church, like most churches, was conservative and went on doing things even when they were no longer popular in secular circles. And there was a strong tradition, especially in cathedral music, but also in hymn tunes and things, which was maintained and developed. And when other kinds of, in other areas of music, people were looking for the music to come from abroad. I mean, there was a strong, it's very hard to beat composers like Beethoven and Schubert and Wagner and Chopin and Verdi. And this was a great time for European music, and people in England and in America wanted to hear these big name composers, and they still do. There wasn't anybody quite in those to rival these in England itself.
One of the people that you've paid a fair amount of attention to, or actually a whole family you've paid a lot of attention to, is one called Wesley. Right. And one of the pieces that's going to be on the program next Saturday on this Anglo-American Musical Connections concert at the Krannert Center is by one of the writer of many cathedral anthems, Samuel Sebastian Wesley. I thought we'd hear that piece, which will be sung by the chorus of the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana under the direction of Chester Alwis on that concert. In this performance, we have the choir of Worcester Cathedral, conducted by Donald Hunt. It's called Thou Wilt Keep Him in Perfect Peace. As the choir of Worcester Cathedral, led by Donald Hunt, music by Samuel Sebastian Wesley, Thou Wilt Keep Him in Perfect Peace, and taking advantage of the cathedral acoustic, no doubt, to nice sustained sounds in there. Beautiful music of the sort that one hears still with great regularity, not only in the English church, but certainly in the Anglican church in America, known as the Episcopal Church. I know this since I'm an Anglican church choir master. I had former choir member of mine always was adamantly opposed to that term. She did not like for someone to be called a choir master. But in any event, that's what we're called, and that's the sort of thing that is regularly performed in churches, as well as lots of other kinds of music as well. But for the point of today's discussion here on Live and Local, it is a piece that will be on the program next Saturday, July 28th, at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in the Follinger Great Hall, called Anglo-American Musical Connections. It's a concert in honor of Nicholas Temperley on his 80th birthday. The piece will be sung by the chorus of the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, and the concert comes at the end of the biennial conference of the North American British Music Studies Association, which is happening on campus next week. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9, where we have support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Brunch is also served on Saturday and Sunday from 10:30 to 2:30. Information on menus, wine, and beer lists is at Radio Maria Restaurant, www.theopeningmusic.com. The conference next week actually has to do with Anglo-American musical connections, and as Nicholas and Christina Bashford pointed out, as we were listening to that music, it's not all about Victorian music. It's about lots of other things as well. And maybe Christina, you can talk about some of the public offerings that are happening during that conference, which runs what, Thursday through to Saturday. Besides this concert.
Yes. Okay. So we do have a number of events that have a sort of public dimension to them. The concert's obviously the biggest one of those, but all the public events very much exploit this idea of Anglo-American musical links and connections. So starting with Thursday, the conference delegates will be attending the Cranet Uncorked wine tasting on Thursday evening at, I think, 5 o'clock. It starts 5 to 7,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, 5 o'clock.
And that's got a theme of Anglo-Americanism throughout, in two ways. One is that we will be tasting American wine and British ale. So not just wine, but beer as well. And there will be a nice little cabaret act going on through that by Andre Streisek and his friends. And they'll be performing all sorts of music with a British-American connection. And that's going to be things like music from Cole Porter's Kiss Me, Kate, which, of course, is based on Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. They're going to be doing some Noel Coward, some Gilbert and Sullivan. Andre's going to play some of the piano music of John Field, an important 19th century composer, Irish composer, but qualifies as British. Also some Percy Grainger. So that's going to be quite a nice little mix of things, a mix of music, a mix of beverage as well.
And so. Gilbert and Sullivan. Nicholas mentioned his interest in Gilbert and Sullivan earlier.
Right.
So there'll be some on that program.
Right. So that's Thursday evening. On Friday, the conference has a keynote lecture. That's the sort of the lead talk that very much sort of captures the spirit of the conference. And that's going to be given by somebody called Patrick Warfield, who I think you've had on your show before.
I think so. He's having to do with Russian studies, though.
Not Russian, no, Sousa. He's an expert on John Philip Sousa. And his...
Is this open to the public?
Yeah, it's open to the public. It's going to be at the Cranet Art Museum at 1:30. The seating's limited, obviously, because the conference delegates will take a good number of the seats, but there will be spaces for anyone who wishes to
come along.
That's next Friday at 1:30. And his talk is called John Philip Sousa, British Copyright and the Making of Popular Taste. And he's talking about the fact that, you know, although Sousa's obviously thought about here as the most patriotic of musicians, what's interesting is that Sousa had a lot of connections with British music, lots of youthful experiences actually orchestrating Gilbert and Sullivan, and some efforts to alter British copyright law, about which I know nothing, so I'm going to be all ears on that. So that's Friday at 1:30. Also, going through the conference and through, I think, to the end of August, is an exhibition at the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, which has the title of, I'm going to get it here, A British Tar, John Philip Sousa's Anglo-American Connections. And that's very much trying to play off the keynote lecture and come up with some visual material offerings that demonstrate some of the things that Pat's going to be talking about. He's a wonderful speaker. I've heard him before. He's been on campus, I think, for the baseball event it's like a couple of years ago.
And of course, the Sousa Archive has a remarkable collection of early brass instruments and things, which I'm sure they'll have on exhibit there.
Oh, I'm sure. And Sousa Archive's located in the Harding Band Building.
Right.
On 6th Street.
6th Street.
Right next to, across from the main university library.
Right. So that's something else that people might like to go to, and that'll be on throughout August. And then, of course, the big thing is the gala concert at the end of the conference on Saturday night.
Well, one of the wonderful things about this conference, a concert, and I'm, full disclosure here, is that I mentioned that I'm the conductor of the Prairie Ensemble, which will be participating in that concert. And I was sort of, well, definitely a co-conspirator in the creation of this concert, along with Christina and Chet Alwis, who directs the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, and Laurie Matheson, who directs the Prairie Voices. Both of those choirs will be involved in the first half of the concert and will join forces for the final piece on the program, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I wanted to ask Nicholas, as I prepare to play a little bit from the symphony that's going to be on that concert, about a massive project you have been involved in for a very long time and still are involved in, and that is the Hymn Tune Index. You indicated earlier an interest in Victorian hymnody from your early days of enforced church attendance, you know, in college. But obviously this has been something you've maintained for all these years, and there are many Anglo-American connections when it comes to hymnody.
Well, I found that when I was looking to see what had been done on the history of English church music, that people always talk about cathedral music and a few other choral foundations where they have professional choirs, like the one we just heard, a splendid choir at Worcester Cathedral. But they never have much to say about what goes on at the ordinary 8,000 or more parish churches in England, in every village and many in the towns as well. And it was pretty skimpy, so I started working on this, and eventually I came up with a complete history of the music of the English parish church, going back to late medieval times and up to whatever date it was that I wrote the book. I think it was 1979. And, of course, much of this had an influence on America, on early American music, practically the only music we have from the 17th and 18th century North America is popular church music, as you might call it, hymn tunes, metrical psalm tunes, and a few slightly more elaborate pieces. And I found that it was very, very difficult to deal with hymn tunes unless you could get some idea where they originated. And often the statements that you found in hymn books were incorrect and so on. So eventually, with the very generous help of the research board here at the U of I and the National Endowment for the Humanities, I started on a massive project for sort of actually recording all printed tunes going right back to the earliest printed editions of hymn tunes, which comes from the 1530s. And we got up as far as we could. When we got to 1820, we had to stop. We were more or less exhausted. But we had by that time recorded about 150,000 printings of hymn tunes from publications in both England and America. So this was certainly an Anglo-American project. And eventually we got it all online, and there it is, the Hymn Tune Index, on a database run by the University Library among their databases, and anybody can look up a hymn tune. There's a simple instructions for how to do it, and you can get the complete history, or you can find what hymns tunes are available for a particular text. You can find what hymn tunes are available by certain composers and so on. There are many different approaches, and it's all there, and we get many, many hits from all over the world on this, and people even write to me and say that their grandmother's funeral is coming up, and she always loved some old hymn tune, but usually it isn't quite old enough for me to be able to answer it, so I've had to give disappointing answers to some of those questions. But if it happens to be before 1820, it's certainly going to be there in the Hymn Tune Index. And I do know quite a lot about later 19th century. I get less knowledgeable when you get into more modern era. So, but anyway, that is a kind of permanent resource of the university, which I'm very proud to have taken part in.
Well, it was because of that project that I think made me think of including in our concert program on July 28th the Third Symphony of Charles Ives, because all the way through this 21, 22, 33 minute work, he quotes hymns as well as marches and other tunes that he grew up with.
Yes.
I have to confess, I haven't studied the Hymn Tune Index in reference to these tunes to see how many of them actually go back far enough. But certainly some of them must, I would think.
Oh, yes, they do, yeah.
Here's a little bit of the first movement. Ives obscures some of the tunes, and you hear little fragments of them. Sometimes you have them heard in their entirety, including at the end of each movement. But this first movement has The title is marked the subtitle for the whole symphony is called The Camp Meeting, and it has to do with a revivalist, a religious revival camp. And first movement called Old Folks Gathering, and he quotes hymns, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, There's a Fountain Filled with Blood. I always love that title. Take It to the Lord in Prayer. And especially prominent is one with the title of Asmon, Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing. Here's the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, led by Dennis Russell Davies, a little bit of the opening movement of the Third Symphony of Charles Ives, which will be in the concert at the Krannert Center on July 28th. That's right in the midst of Charles Ives playing around with the tune Asmon, Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing, and gives you nearly the whole tune, which is one of the few times that happens in the symphony until, as I said, at the end of each of the movements. It's a three-movement piece. Symphony number 3, The Camp Meeting, played here by the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, led by Dennis Russell Davies. It'll be performed by the Prairie Ensemble, conducted by yours truly, on July 28th in the Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, on the second half of a concert called Anglo-American Musical Connections. And it's a concert in honor of Nicholas Temperley, professor emeritus of musicology at the University of Illinois. Now, it says here on his birthday, but in fact, I believe your birthday is in August.
Yes, that is true. I'm still enjoying being in the 70s, but not for much longer.
No, not for much longer. So this is only about a week or 8 or 10 days ahead of your actual birthday.
That's right.
That's happening. Well, it's an honor to have you on the program. We've had you on before, and we have really still not picked your brain. It is so full of things. One of the things that I asked Christina Bashford at the beginning of the show, when she'd first heard or encountered your name, and I can't remember when I first encountered your name, but I can remember that it seemed to me that I kept encountering it in relation to a great many different things, some of which I thought, now usually with musicologists, somebody has a narrow focus. Like we've mostly talked about Victorian music, but I would see your name connected with that. I'd see, I knew you'd made an edition of Haydn's Creation.
Right.
And I knew that you had made an edition of the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, and I'm thinking, how on earth did that get in there, given the other, I didn't quite get that. So one of the things that I've been curious about is what tickles your fancy? I mean, how have you decided what to spend enormous amounts of your free time, as it were, on to study, something as disparate as the Haydn Creation versus Symphony Fantastique?
Well, I mean, I like most 18th and 19th century music, as so many of our listeners do, and I get particularly interested in some piece, and then I read what people have said about it, and I sometimes question it, and I look into the sources of information, and I find that I can say something new about it, and I like editing music, especially if it's going to be performed, and I've gone to various composers. It's true, from Haydn to Chopin to Schubert and Mozart, and these are all composers I'm greatly attached to, and if there seems to be an opportunity to say something new about them, or if I'm asked to say to edit. I was asked to look into the text of Haydn's Creation, which is a very complex business because it's half German and half English. Where does the English side of it come in? The piece is usually performed in German, even to English-speaking audiences, but Haydn actually wanted it to be done in English and wrote it originally for an English audience. And so the text, what text to sing is a very difficult problem, And I found this intriguing, and of course I love the music, and so it was a pleasure both to produce a new edition of the music with an English text and to write a book about it. And that's the kind of thing that happens. I don't know what more I can say on that subject.
Can I just add, as a sort of further demonstration of that, actually, that Nicholas is giving a paper at the conference on the Scotch snap, right?
Oh, yes. Well, that's something new. And I have a son, David, who is teaches at Eton School of Music, but he's got into a fairly new field called music perception, and music cognition, which tries to figure out how the brain deals with music. And we find we have common interests in a number of different things. And we got interested in something called the Scotch snap, as in, again, a body meet a body coming through the rye. Now, that funny rhythm that you get on the word body is connected by many people with Scottish music, but I wanted to know where it came from. It's always called the Scotch snap. But it turned out that it's common in a lot of other English songs as well, not just Scottish, and it turns out that it has something to do with a peculiarity of the English language, which has these very short vowels on words like body or pity, which come on a stressed syllable. So I'm going to be talking about that when I give a paper at this conference, and we have a joint publication that I did with my son, which is coming out in the magazine Music Perception on that subject. So I get interested in all kinds of things, and I'm fortunate enough to be retired now, and I can do what I like with my time.
Well, fair enough. And I'll have you know that as soon as Christina said Scotch snap, I thought, oh, I know what that is. I'm sure I know what that is. I hope I know what that is. And as soon as you sang the thing, I thought, yes, I knew what that was, because I wasn't positive that I remembered. But it does show up so many times in so many different kinds of music.
Oh, yes.
I'd be interested to hear that myself. Have you spent, Nicholas, any time studying American music particularly? I mean, I know you have a book, for example, on some three particular English composers who came to the United States and how things went for them then. You, of course, came to the United States. You're a naturalized American citizen. But have you spent much time doing anything on American music itself?
Well, only the very earliest period, I wrote an article once called The First 40, the first 40 surviving American compositions, and they turned out to be almost entirely hymn tunes, which of course fit, that's how I got interested in them. I'm sure there were other American music going on at that time. This is in the 18th century. Before Billings, the first great American composer, who in 1770 produced a book of over 200, I think, original compositions, but nothing like that had happened before in America. And I wanted to know what American compositions could be dug up from before 1770. You know, there must have been something going on. And it turned out that there was, but the ones that have been recorded in print are almost entirely hymn tunes, because it wasn't worthwhile printing music, which was an expensive occupation, unless it was going to be bought by a large number of people. So that's the kind of music that tended to get printed in that period. But of course, I'm sure there are many American folk songs and things that go back to that date, but it's very difficult to establish who was responsible for them, when they first appeared, or even to get an authentic copy of these early versions. So we just have to take what we can get from the way they've been passed on orally, you know, and have survived to this day. You can't get very accurate information about their origins.
This concert that is happening on the 28th, called Anglo-American Musical Connections, as is the conference next week of the North American British Music Studies Association, has not only connections that are specifically musical, but also instances where the composer adapted, for example, we have an American composer who adapted text by an English author, Irving Fine, for example, American composer, not very well known, unfortunately, although he's written some beautiful music, taking texts from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, mm-hmm. of which, and I might remember correctly, and you can tell me if I'm misremembering this, Christina, that I actually thought of these pieces when we were talking about the program initially, because I remembered singing the piece I'm about to play when I was in high school. And I remembered about half the song, which is really unusual for me.
I don't remember which song it was. We're going to hear.
We're going to hear it right now. This is from Irving Fine's settings of songs from Alice in Wonderland. Father William, setting from one of the choruses from Alice in Wonderland by Irving Fine, and sung here by a chamber chorus directed by Norman Scribner. This was from a live concert at the Library of Congress. I don't know the date, unfortunately. That was a concert of Irving Fine's music. And that piece will be sung on the concert on July 28th at the Krannert Center by the Prairie Voices under the direction of Laurie Matheson. That group also will sing a piece talking of Anglo-American musical connections where it goes the other way around. In that case, an American composer setting a British text. We also have some pieces of a British composer setting an American text. In this case, actually adapting an American musical art form altogether, the African-American spiritual. Michael Tippett. It's an oratorio, isn't it? A Child of Our Time, incorporated five Negro spirituals at various points in that oratorio, and Laurie's group is going to be performing three of those, including this one, which is Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, or I See, performed here by the Christ Church Cathedral Choir, led by Stephen Darlington. It's Sir Michael Tippett's setting from his oratorio, A Child of Our Time. That'll be performed on the Anglo-American Musical Connections Concert in honor of Nicholas Temperley next Saturday, July 28th, at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana, the culmination of the three-day conference on the University of Illinois campus by the North American British Music Studies Association. That concert, principally organized by Professor Christina Bashford, who is one of my guests on the program today. And, of course, we have the honoree of that concert, Professor Emeritus Nicholas Temperley, on the program as well. The three ensembles involved in that concert, the Prairie Ensemble, the Prairie Voices, who will sing that Michael Tippett piece on their portion of the program, and the Chorus and Orchestra of the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, led by Chester Alwis. And Chet's group is going to be, I think it's Chet's group, is going to be doing some music by Robert Pearsall. Mm-hmm. Am I saying his name right?
Yes.
This is somebody who comes in that Victorian era that we were referring to at the beginning.
That's right.
I believe. Is he somebody that you spent some time on?
Yes, he's sort of one of a kind because he got very interested in much earlier music and wrote madrigals. He studied Elizabethan madrigals and tried to write things in that style. And this is an example of this, but it doesn't sound quite Elizabethan. But you can see a kind of link there. And he sort of expanded entirely in his own way on this remote style of 300 years earlier, or 200 or 300 years earlier, which was something that was beginning to happen much more often. And he was one of the pioneers of what we call musical antiquarianism. And many other people, of course, have done that since then, have based their style, including Ives, among others, have based their style in part on earlier styles, but still done something creative and new with them. And so Purcell was one of the first people to do this. And I think this is a very beautiful piece for 8 voices, quite short, with all sorts of extraordinary harmonic effects.
It's wonderful dissonances.
Hmm.
I'm not even sure I know the piece. I'll find out, I guess, as we hear it. It's called Leah Garland. And, well, hopefully you'll understand the text. One of the problems about choral music so much of the time is it really can be difficult to project text. So we'll give a listen, and if we agree we didn't hear it well enough, I'll read it to you, because it's a wonderful poem. Music by Robert Pearsall. This performers here are the Cambridge Singers, led by John Rutter, on Live and Local. That's called Leah Garland, music by Robert Pearsall, and text by, it says here, Beaumont and Fletcher. Who are Beaumont and Fletcher?
Well, they were a pair who wrote plays and some poems in the 17th century.
And the text here, because I'm looking at it, and I really didn't understand what they were singing, so I'll just tell people, because it's beautiful. Leah Garland on her hearse of dismal yew, maidens willow branches wear, say she died true, her love was false, but she was firm. Upon her buried body lie lightly, thou gentle earth. Sung by the Cambridge Singers in this recording, led by John Rutter. It'll be sung by the chorus of the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, conducted by Professor Chester Alwis, on that concert of Anglo-American Musical Connections next Saturday, July the 28th at 7:30. An unusual concert in that at the Krannert Center, you actually get to have some community ensembles who normally don't have the opportunity to perform there, and a collaborative concert between the Baroque Artists, the Prairie Ensemble, the Prairie Voices. Thanks to Christina Bashford for pulling all of us together for that concert. And thanks to Professor Nicholas Temperley for inspiring the whole thing through his, I don't want to say 80 years of work in musicology, but 80 years of life that resulted in many, many years of fabulous work in musicology. We'll wrap up in just a moment with just a tiny bit of the closing work on the program. I'm going to mention just a couple of few other events you can see and hear live in our listening area, at least today. The Illinois Shakespeare Festival tonight at 8 o'clock presents a non-Shakespearean play called The Rivals. That's at 8 o'clock. The Bart Walker Band is at Central Park in Decatur tonight at 6 o'clock. The Celebration Company at the Station Theater presents the musical Rent at 8 o'clock tonight. That's in Urbana. The Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan presents The Music Man at 2 o'clock and 8 o'clock today. The Dan White Sextet with Drew Ninmer is at the Iron Post in Urbana, 7 o'clock tonight. The Brad Wheeler Country Jazz Project is at Bouvon's in Urbana tonight at 8 o'clock. And it's the Sugar Prophets and the Feudin' Hillbillies at the High Dive in Champaign tonight at 8 o'clock. Finally, Joni Dreyer, Matt Stewart, and Bob Watson are all at Clark Bar in Champaign tonight at 6:30. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translators, W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We also have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday features a tasting for support of the CU Schools Foundation, followed from 7 to 9 by the music of David Howie. For more information on the concert we've been talking about, you can go to the Krannert Center's website, which is krannertcenter.com. And you can go to the School of Music website. Actually, if you go to the Krannert website, there's a link to events for the North American British Music Studies Association conference that are open to the public. Much of it, of course, is closed for conference members, but there are the other public events that Christina mentioned at the beginning of the show. Thanks, Christina. Thanks, Nicholas, very much for coming and joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And happy birthday a couple of weeks in advance.
Thanks.
Nicholas. The last piece on the program, which will bring together all of the performing forces on that concert, is purely English. It is by Rayfon Williams, in which he is setting a text from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. Calls it his Serenade to Music, and it will involve the combined choruses, soloists, and orchestra. Here in this performance, the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, led by Robert Spano.